Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Now the story of a few guys who love technology and social media, and the one show that had no choice but to bring them all together. It's The Drill Down. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Anofoaki.
This week, a bidding war starts and ends over Waze. Yahoo wants Hulu. Tim Cook spills the beans about, well, nothing. Blizzard drops its new MMO from the schedule. Some backlash on Microsoft's new Xbox One. A 3D food printer and the possible look of the next PlayStation. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. You can subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our iTunes link is in the right-hand sidebar, facebook.com/thedrilldown, and twitter.com/thedrilldown. Before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And as you can glean from that intro, this week I want to talk about Arrested Development Season 4. So Arrested Development is back on the air after a seven-year absence from TV on where it used to be on Fox. And now Netflix has it exclusively following their, this is one of their new exclusives like Hemlock Grove and House of Cards. And Welcome to Lilyhammer previous, they struck quite a coup in getting Arrested Development from Fox. So you've been watching this, Tosin. Dwayne, you haven't seen this. You haven't caught up with this yet. But Tosin,
I haven't caught up with the actual content, but I've actually been following the release and the implications quite closely when it comes to the way the media has been dealing with it, especially with the way the finances and financials have been dealing with it.
And Tosin, you've been watching the episodes as well.
Yeah, no, I think I've seen the first four or five episodes. I've been taking it slowly and kind of letting it sink in. Also because in the online distribution that Netflix has, the episode lengths vary from, I think, 37 minutes and below. And in
right.
the TV distribution, they used to only be 22 minutes.
Used to be 22, long. Adding right. Time for ads.
Exactly. And so... although it's a different style where each episode is now individual character based.
Right.
As you can tell, they didn't have the complete cast together. I'm still really enjoying it. For me, it's still, not all episodes are created equally, but there's still that Arrested Development charm. And I'm really glad to be back in this universe. I've missed this lighthearted comedy just kind of disappeared at a moment's notice, and I'm glad that we're getting more episodes.
It feels good to be with these characters again, doesn't it? I mean,
how do you guys feel about what it is now? Is this a revival? Is it a resurrection? Is it the end of a hiatus? Like, how do you guys feel about the vibe from now, from what you remember?
Well, I mean, it is different because as Tosin hinted there. The way they approach this is instead of telling this sort of serialized linear story that runs through all of the episodes, every character has their own episode that they're the focus of. And the stories of the other characters kind of weave in the background of each of the individual characters' stories. And from what I'm gathered, I'm about four episodes in. And I'm already starting to see puzzle pieces, in the background that are starting to fall into place, where you see a couple of incidental things going on in the background on the scene in one episode, a couple episodes down the road when you're watching the episode that's the focus of another character, you see those things that were incidental in the background of the previous episode. In full focus in the episode of a different character. So it's like this giant sort of jigsaw puzzle with the events of all of these characters and you don't really get the big picture until I think you see the whole thing. This is it immediately lends itself to rewatching, I think, once you've seen the whole thing one time through.
Or just motivating people like me who have been holding off on watching the third season.
Yeah.
Because it was like, it's over. I have to save it for like a rainy day when like I have a bad day at work. I pull this one out. I pull out the Boondocks, and I pull out It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
And already it's broken records. According to a technology company, Procera Networks, which measures broadband usage, 1DSL Network had 36% of devices watching Netflix on Sunday night when they released the episodes. That's three times the number of Netflix's previous high-profile entry, House of Cards.
Let's talk about the rollout a little bit.
Yeah.
Netflix decided to roll this out on Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah.
People are obviously out. There's the barbecue thing. People are on vacation, whatever. But Netflix has an advantage that TV doesn't have, and that's that you can watch it wherever you are. Right? If you have a laptop and you're at a hotel, if you have an iPad and you're at a friend's house that night, if you're at a friend's house and they've got any kind of device that connects to Netflix, you know, that night, that you know, Sunday night, Saturday night, you can get into a couple episodes of the rest of the development. You have even enough time to watch some old episodes before you get into the new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and then
exactly.
You have time to talk about it. And more than that, as I was driving up to I was in Sonoma this weekend, and I was driving around in Sonoma, my phone buzzed letting me know that the new episodes are ready.
That's awesome.
Yep.
I don't
I got
get
an email
many push
–
you got an email. I don't get many push notifications from Netflix.
Uh-huh.
And this is a big deal because when I do, it's important. Mm-hmm. Netflix has done a very good job of making the mobile experience such that when I look at that notification center on my Nexus 7 or on my iPad or on my my iPhone, I'm like, whoa, okay, got to figure that out. You make the announcement to your friends who are also in the room, and suddenly it's on the plan for that night.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, whose house are we going to go to, whatever. So they've found a way to take the TV watching experience, and even though it's all on demand, to coalesce people around it. They sold it. They gave us a date. They let us built up some buzz.
Mm-hmm.
They did all that. And, you know, the launch, I think, was just as important as the actual series. Obviously, you talked about last week, the whole old media, new media thing, but they were really able to take this launch together. Now, what's really interesting is that despite the fact that everyone's been waiting for this, there's been some backlash about the new format, about the new seasons, about some of the flashback scenes, and about this idea that it's one character at a time kind of stuff. So much so that Netflix's stock has been rocked by what's going on.
Really?
Here. Yeah, Netflix's stock is down in trading after this long weekend. And that's completely due to investor perceptions of the, you know, of what's going on with Netflix, which to me signals a lot of craziness. It signals a couple things. One, let's look at what Andy just said. They've been looking at Netflix, and the, you know, Netflix themselves reported, and this other team reported, that the viewership is up, over House of Cards up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like they had Lilyhammer, they had the other show, and Hemlock Grove. And frankly, the content wasn't as awesome as the two recent new releases. And, you know, whatever. It wasn't awesome, but Netflix was trying out something new. And the fact is Netflix got smart with the data. They found some big-name stars, and they put together the House of Cards, and it was awesome. Everyone is universally agreeing. It's going to be critically acclaimed. It might be more critically acclaimed than the new Arrested Development. But the fact is Arrested Development sold. People are watching mm-hmm. Netflix for Arrested Development. And that's not big news because, okay, people are watching Arrested Development on Netflix, cool. It's big news because when Netflix is showing you a show, they've got either one or another type of license agreement. One saying, we have the show for this many views, or one saying, we have the show for this amount of time, this many years. But when you're watching something that Netflix owns, that Netflix produced, that Netflix made, they're not paying anything. They've made it already.
Pure profit.
It's pure profit. They're working on what they can. You know, they've got your subscription, and you're watching it, and they're not worrying about anything. They just want to see the take rate. They want to get more people viewing their stuff. Yada yada yada. The fact that more people in these last several days have seen Arrested Development than have seen House of Cards. And we're not even counting the multiple people gathering around a TV. We're just thinking about the devices and the bandwidth and the usership. Shows that this is a straight win for the Netflix model.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when I look at these other these companies that are like trying to evaluate Netflix and figure out like, oh, the stock should drop because people aren't liking it or whatever, I think to myself that, you know, Apple isn't the only company that's somewhat suffering from the way, you know, financial analysts view that technology and where the value is from a traditional output perspective. Netflix is seeing this too. Now, we saw the Netflix stock drop a little bit when the whole Flixster Netflix thing showed up, because that was clearly a poor decision making, this decision. But they bounced back since then. And when you look at what's going on with this whole launch of Arrested Development, you see that it's clearly a win. But the financial analysts don't see it as such. And to me, that's bothersome, because it shows that the way we view the economy, or the way, not the economy, the way we view the prospect of a company in these old economic indicators is not necessarily appropriate for these newly minted business models in the tech sector. So I think that's like an overarching problem that I think is worth mentioning on the drill down, where we talk about not just the echo chamber, but what's really going on in the news.
Yeah, you know what's actually going back on a point you said about people just watching it from all over and anywhere. I was in New York in a hotel, and what I found very interesting is TV is also, the TV stations are also jumping in on this bandwagon. For one, I noticed Netflix commercials for Arrested Development on TV, as well as there was a station, I can't remember if it was ION or some other station was actually showing old Arrested, was doing an Arrested Development marathon.
Mm-hmm.
And so I watched Arrested Development in the hotel a couple hours before heading off to a wedding, and it was amazing. So
it was amazing. I like that. Let me just tell you, it was amazing. Yeah, exactly. So everyone cashes in. TV wins because TV can play episodes that have been aired previously and that they have access to in syndication. TV wins because Netflix is going to pay TV money to promote this. Now, this is a lot, you know, it's not something that's going to happen forever as Netflix takes more and more, you know, eyeballs off of TV. But everybody's winning. And yet somehow the analysts are like, no, sell Netflix. And that's troublesome in terms of the way we look at finance in this country.
Yeah, but doesn't it also sort of remind you, I mean, I don't want to, it's not apples to apples, get it? But yeah, doesn't it somewhat remind you of that? Although
that's what that's exactly why I mentioned Apple computer, Apple, because I mentioned the idea that, you know, we're seeing this company that does incredibly well. It's up there with Exxon. It's up there with Chevron in terms of its profits. Yet, because it's not chasing down market share, instead it's chasing profits. That seems like to the analysts who I think even in 2012 do not understand the tech sector and what it means to grab a consumer and what the lifetime value of a consumer is for these technology companies. I think that they're screwing up, and I think that they're able to hold their old hat. They're able to rely on the people who have tons of money in their systems are relying on them heavily, and they're able to rely on that old capital, that old social capital, that old understanding of how it is, and get funded and get backed by, you know, people who would otherwise not know what they're doing. And it's a shame, because it's clear that Apple is winning when it comes to profits in mobile. It's clear that Netflix is winning when it comes to a new model for how to deal with this stuff. And it's clear, like, for instance, Samsung is winning with the way they're dealing with Android. But you're not always seeing, 2 out of 3 of those cases, you're not seeing it reflected in their stock price. Which if you've got a mutual fund, people are making bad bets. At least that's the perspective I have right now.
Yeah, the last note which I would like to add here is that there are also recent articles which have said that the owner, the CEO of Netflix, has definitely said that, you know, he would totally be interested in shelling out money for for more seasons of Arrested Development. So that door hasn't completely been shut.
Right, and you know what? The fact is Netflix, unlike a traditional TV company, can hear firsthand the response from their consumers, and Netflix does respond. We know that with the whole Flixster debacle. It wasn't the investors and other people who said, hey, Flickster's stupid, don't do it. It was the users. And Netflix changed. They adapted. If they discover that it's gonna be worth it to them to pay however much more they have to pay to get every single one of those cast members together for every episode of the next season, you guys are going to be filming for 10 weeks. That's what's up. Here's your money. Then Netflix is going to do it because we will watch and it will be better. So I think that the financial analysts are losing the understanding that Netflix has the data to figure out how to pivot. They have the data and the reach, the communication skills and the communications technology and the infrastructure in terms of their personnel available to get an idea of the sentiment of their brand as well as what they're doing. And that allows them to pivot in ways that's brand new. And the fact is, when it comes to anything, a TV show comes out, you're not going to hear as many people loving it as you hear as many people hating on it, because that's just how things work in the world. People complain louder than they appreciate. So I don't know. I'm excited to check it out. Obviously, I have to get through season 3, mm-hmm. which I've been saving. But I think the real story here that no one's really reporting about is how, you know, finance and big business isn't looking at the Netflix model and its effectiveness. It's in a way that's conducive to it's in a way that's tied to its value, its true value to the user.
Yeah, I think the bottom line is here on this is. The experiment is a success. Netflix's original programming experiment is a success, and so is the binge watching, the taking a gamble on binge watching.
Right. I mean, that's another thing right there. The binge watching. You want to do it. You want to lose time to this. People used to do a lot more reading. Fine, but you know, this is what's happening. You're not spending time watching commercials. You're getting more value out of it by just sitting there and watching. 4 episodes in a row. That's what, a little bit more than 2 hours with the new model, and that's time you could have had your nose in a book. And it's the same value, I think, to many people. Except, you know, you can giggle with your friends about it in real time. So I don't know. I feel like I'm excited about what they're doing. I'm a fan.
All right, let's move on into headlines here. So I was going to talk about the bidding war between Google and Facebook over the travel app company Waze. But Facebook dropped out of negotiations today to try and acquire Waze.
Biggest mistake ever.
Yeah. No. I think there's definitely something there. And in fact, Apple as well admitted that they're not attempting to pursue Waze either. So if Google wants Waze, it seems to be clear, you know, clear sailing from here for them.
Now, Google has
to discuss what Waze is.
Yeah. It's a social GPS is basically the nutshell description of it. It's a GPS app that allows you to log on.
Okay, wait, it's not a GPS app. It is a navigation app that uses GPS.
Sure.
It's not just there to like, hey, here's a GPS, here's where you are. Waze is a navigation app that uses your GPS hardware in your telephone to tell you how to get somewhere. But what it does is it layers in the ability for the crowd around you to input what's going on the road. So if there's a police officer who has stopped your car in the median and is gunning people with their radar gun at a speed trap, Waze is going to tell you that's coming up. If there's a stopped car on the side of the road, or there's an accident, or there's just traffic, Waze is not only going to tell you that, but they're going to tell you what the people have said is the best way to get around it. The crowdsourced community in Waze makes Waze, for many people, far and away the best navigation app around. And that's what makes Waze worthy of note, remarkable. The fact that people are able to hop in there, it's a native app. It's not any kind of like web-based thing. And it really focuses on how to get you and your passenger to easily communicate what's going on the road to help the people that are in front or behind you. It's to that end, it's fantastic. We used it all weekend long, and it was very helpful.
Yep. I had some great experiences with Waze, particularly in avoiding traffic, and in a richer, more granulated way than I've ever had with the Apple Maps or Google Maps as well.
Waze's only problem is that it's not default. And maybe in iOS 7 we'll see the the ability to set some default apps. But the way, that's Waze's only issue. And the fact that Facebook, and we can talk about Facebook for hours, obviously, but Facebook had a chance to magnetically attract their users to be on Facebook, yeah, and to collect an enormous amount of data about how their users travel, yeah, and to cement the core of Facebook, which is meaningful user interaction, in a way that wasn't based on pictures, which is really the vast majority of how people use Facebook. They had picked up Waze for, let's say, $300-400 million or something like that. They really would have had, I think, a new revenue stream, a new way to get users to engage, and a new way to tell investors that they are trying to make a play that, you know, directly goes after one of Google's current, you know, bread, like one of Google's current wheelhouses, which is navigation.
Yeah.
And yet they didn't. Apple, you know, Apple could pick up something like Waze in a moment. They've got the money to, but the fact is, it's not the curation of the experience is crowdsourced, and Apple's never been comfortable with social.
Right.
So I can see why they'd walk away. Google is already heads and shoulders above everyone else when it comes to navigation, with the exception of this app. If they pick it up, then I think we're looking at Google as the market leader in navigation.
Yep.
For the next 5-10 years, no doubt. Everyone's going to be behind them a lot. The company that should buy Waze,
mm-hmm,
the company that should go after Waze and just like spend every penny they have on Waze is Yahoo. You're laughing, but Yahoo.
No, I'm laughing because you're right. Really, I mean, they should do essentially what they just did with Tumblr, and try and get Waze as well.
So, in your opinions, do you think Waze is worth more than $1 billion?
No, I think Waze is a newer situation. I don't know how many users Waze has, but I know they're very active. I know that they do a good job of updating the app. They do, you know, the code is obviously very valuable because they figured so much stuff out and how to get it done. But I would say that I mean, and I'm one of those people who doesn't think that Tumblr was necessarily worth $1 billion, although it was worth a lot of money, and that Instagram could have been bought for less. I'm looking at Waze in the space between $300 and $600 million, and at $600 million, they're very lucky people.
Yeah, because they were offered that much money, but it sounds like, for one, they turned it down, thinking that their valuation was worth a lot more.
If they take some time, I mean, face it, they're so new on the market. They've been around for maybe, I think they've been extremely popular for about 24 months, if that, maybe 18 months. They've been extremely popular for 18 months. If they hang out and they become a user standard amongst people who are not necessarily traffic geeks or just geeks in general, then they're looking at the kind of valuation that puts them at $1 billion pretty easily. You know, this is an app that generates data in a way that Tumblr can't, in a way that Instagram can't. Now, does it generate data? It's one of those things where the data that it generates isn't just some psychographic stuff on the users. You can figure out traffic patterns. You can sell that to the government. And the best customer in the world to have is the U.S. government, because they will pay any money for anything. So, there's a lot there if they want to hold on to it and grow it out a little bit more. And they have, you know, they'll get the investor funding. They'll get the funding.
The thing which I find interesting about it is, typically what I've found so far in, you know, startups in the Valley here, or even organizations in the Valley here, is that it's often much more than the application itself. It's, mm-hmm, the application often is nice, but it's more along the lines of getting the developers and actually incorporating them within your organization.
That's a yes and no. That's a certain strategy. But Waze is such a unique product.
Yeah.
You're not going to take people from Waze and throw them at your other thing. If you're Google, you're going to take Waze and you're going to wrap a layer of Waze around your existing platform.
Right.
Or you're going to spend money pushing Waze up. Like when Yahoo bought Tumblr, they didn't buy it to get the Tumblr. It's not an acqui-hire, as Andy calls them.
Right.
We want that service and we want to make it better. we're going to be able to put our money into Tumblr. And we're going to be able to get, you know, we're going to be able to integrate advertising with it to monetize it better. But we're not going to try to stop Tumblr from happening the way that Facebook stopped Beluga, the way that, you know, Google, you know, stopped whatever it is that they bought recently. I forgot what it's called. But
yeah, I think it's more like an Instagram purchase where you incorporate them in your organization and they continue working on that application and integrating it better with your current existing architecture.
Well, apparently that's why the talks broke down, is because Waze wanted to stay in Israel and Facebook wanted to fold them, to bring them over to their Menlo Park headquarters.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big deal. A company that's that size, that's that unique, is that way because of where it's based. And if you want to relocate them, that's a problem. Now, I understand why you want to relocate them. You're Facebook. You have an army of developers. And you're not trying to be inefficient by flying them out to Israel on a regular basis. But if your ways, you're like, hey, this is where I am. I've got reasons to be here. And it's not like you're moving me from Texas or Boulder or Seattle to Menlo Park. You're moving me from Israel, you know? So that's huge. That's a big, big, big move. Google is at a different stage of growth than Facebook. And frankly, they're probably in a better position to manage a team that's that far away because they have global offices.
Sure.
All over the place.
Speaking of Yahoo being the ideal company to buy a hot startup like Waze, according to numerous sources, Yahoo has bid from $600 million to $800 million for Hulu. I think with this strategy, we're really sort of beginning to see Yahoo's overall strategy since Marissa Meyer's reboot.
I don't know if we're beginning to see it. Yahoo's strategy for the last 5 or 6 years is to be content focused. Marissa Meyer is able to take that focus and, you know, bring it to the next level. But I don't think Yahoo's changing its strategy. They're not interested with the Microsoft connection. They haven't been interested in being a fully technology company, like building and figuring out search algorithms and so on, for a very long time. They've been interested in getting people to their place as a portal and then consuming content, whether it's through affiliate or user-generated content.
But it seems clear to me that they want to buy something that already exists and is already cool, you know?
Yep.
And Hulu is, again, another site that they, you know, the people who currently own, the companies that currently own Hulu, they're getting to the end of their usage of it, and they're going to have to sell it off to somebody, and I think this is a perfect opportunity for Yahoo to create their own sort of Netflix with Hulu.
I think this is actually somewhat of a mistake.
Uh-huh.
So they would have to significantly change Hulu to make Hulu good, and by that I mean, let's take Hulu and who's the next biggest competitor. I would throw Netflix in the ring when it comes to that.
All right.
Hulu is a response by the networks, by Fox, by Comcast, by all these guys, to give users access to content online in a way to thwart the Netflix juggernaut.
Sure.
And the reason why Hulu is as big as it is because all these guys have the money to promote it and to put their content on it and all these things. But Hulu is a very confusing experience. If I'm on Hulu and I want to watch a show that came out yesterday, I might be able to see it on Hulu, or I might have to wait 30 days.
If I'm on Hulu and
I want to watch a certain TV show, I may be able to watch it on my television via my PS3, or I might not because the deal says I can only watch it on a computer screen, or I might only be able to watch it on my iPad. And if I watch Hulu and I've been paying for Hulu, let's say I'm paying the $7 a month or whatever it is, I'm still subject to commercial advertisements instead of just getting, you know, what I'm paying for from my subscription. Whereas on Netflix, I'm not. Or on Amazon Prime, I'm not. So Hulu has a lot of issues that it's clear that the old media companies have tied themselves to its business model or its way of working that is not native to the way we consume media digitally. The fact that and they don't have a crazy amount of sponsors. So you'll watch two episodes of something on Hulu and you'll see the same commercial. Let's say it's a 2-hour-long, 43-minute episodes. You'll see the same commercial on Hulu like 9 times. How many times can you see the Tide commercial? It's painful. It's a soap opera, I guess, because it's a soap company that's sponsoring it. It's really not a great experience for anyone who's been able to get Amazon Prime on their television set or Netflix on their television set or any of those things.
Sure, but it's clear that if they do get something like a Hulu, they'll have to take a different tack than they did with Tumblr, where they buy it and their intention is just to let it run the way it has always run. With Hulu, you buy it and then you rehaul the whole thing from top to bottom.
But the question is it a white elephant? And a white elephant, by that I mean a long time ago, the Rajas used to give a Raja they didn't like a white elephant. It's a wonderful gift. It's incredibly rare, or white rhinoceros. It's a wonderful gift, an incredibly rare. But the fact is you've got to feed it and it's very expensive. Yeah. And if they just take Hulu and they have to revamp Hulu and they're just keeping the brand, but they're changing everything else.
Well, it's essentially like Napster.
I mean, that's what I'm saying. Yahoo has to throw an army of engineers at Hulu. Yahoo has to throw an army of salespeople to get content deals. It's a very expensive proposition to maintain. It's not a question of buying it and saying, here's some money, go forth. You know the best way to run this product, like Instagram or Tumblr. It's saying, okay, we have you. You're clearly broken. You're perhaps even more broken than we are. You've just been buttressed by a whole bunch of really wealthy companies for a long time. That's the horror. I see that movie, The Money Pit, right. When I look at Hulu.
Right. Well, the one thing that Hulu has, the one advantage that they would have is they already have the established relationships with the licensees.
That's true, but a lot of those licensees are not happy with Hulu to begin with, which is why they don't get along. They really don't like the efficiency of watching the content online because they're getting more money from the content being on the television stations and getting advertisers to pay for 30-second spots on TV. That's the problem. That's where the white elephant aspect comes in. It's the complication isn't in the fact that people know who it is or that, you know, Fox and Comcast are behind Hulu. They're behind Hulu as long as they own it. But once they don't, you're going to be right by Netflix, bidding against Amazon for content.
Mm-hmm.
And – you know, I don't know how Hulu's structured, but it doesn't seem like that's going to be an easy thing for Yahoo to compete with out the gate, you know? Meanwhile, you know, Google's getting into the content buying thing situation, and Yahoo's going to have to compete against them, too. That marketplace is pretty full, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, with people who have a lot of money to spend on stuff. And if Yahoo just spent $1 billion on Tumblr, and Yahoo having the trouble that it had in the past, it's hard to say that they're going to be able to really compete in that space.
Moving on here, I just wanted to mention this little item here. Lambda Labs, an early stage startup out of San Francisco, is preparing to release a facial recognition API for developers working on Google Glass apps. Now, what I thought was interesting about this is the idea is applied to Glass, the technology will enable apps to such as remember this face or find your friends in a crowd, or more. The idea behind this is kind of like the killer app for Google Glass. This is what really everybody wants when they think about Google Glass, is they want to be able to put the glasses on, go to a convention, see somebody that you knew from last year at the convention, and immediately pull up their name, their wife and kids, and be able to converse with them without missing a beat, you know, without...
I don't know. Well, killer app is kind of a painful term. But more important than that, I haven't heard that many people are crazy about that functionality. I don't know. I feel like that's... Is that really... I mean, like, if you're...
I would love that. I would love to be able to... because I have a problem with names. I know faces. I have a problem with names. So I would love to be able to wear Google Glass and know immediately who this person is that I'm talking to and not feel like a complete oaf. You know, and even if people know that I'm cheating by using Glass to tell me what their name is, it's kind of like wearing it's kind of like having implants, you know. Even if you know that the breasts are fake, no one's going to come right out and point at you.
I don't know that.
Yeah, I'm as uncomfortable as Tosin was with that.
Well, no, not necessarily there, but I guess it all depends how they do it. But it's
what about a
fucking
name tag?
It's often pretty obvious that you can. I'm bad with names too, but it's actually pretty obvious when you're looking at something on Google Glass that, like, if someone's looking at you, they can often see exactly what you are looking at too. So now, wouldn't that be awkward for someone you just took a photo of?
Hey, let me look you up. You have, right, exactly.
Their photo is there, plus like their name.
But that technology will get better.
And also, if I'm wearing Google Glass at a conference,
yeah,
I'm necessarily not paying direct attention to the person that I'm speaking with. Google Glass is not something that you wear. Currently, Google Glass is something that wears you.
I don't know about that. The Google I.O. conference had the largest concentration of Google Glass.
Sure, and that's a whole bunch of Google geeks. But if you're in a general-based conference at this stage in the game, or let's even say a year out, let's say Google Glass is available for everybody for $2,000 a pop, a bunch of people have it, it's still something that is so it's designed in such a way that it's like wearing that Louis Vuitton dress with LVs all over it.
Yeah.
He makes bags, he doesn't make dresses, but that's I'm making an analogy here. It's this idea that you're not wearing it, it's wearing you. Your identity is now a Google Glass person, not like just who you are. So you're talking to whomever and they're like, okay, and frankly, you can get around the Tosin situation and you can look across the room, see somebody, look them up before they get over there, you know, whatever, and then walk over and be like, hey, Jared, how's it going? Yeah, whatever, whatever, whatever. That's totally the way it would work in today's world. But I don't think that the real timiness, especially in a conference where you don't have bandwidth to begin with, is I don't know. I don't see that as the killer app. I see the killer app as something along the lines of being able to communicate with an individual who's communicate some meaningful data, like real-time video or something, with an individual who's really far away, and be able to do that in a way that's awesome and meaningful. I don't see it as like, oh, I'm at a conference. I don't know. It doesn't sway me as a consumer who goes to conferences, and you know, I don't have lots of trouble with names, but human beings have lots of trouble with names, and people are okay with that. People are like, you walk up to someone and you say, hey, how's it going? You know, I'm really bad with names. And as long as you're honest, they'll be like, yeah, it's Jeffrey. Hi, how's it going? Yada, yada, yada. We met last year at whatever.
Yeah, but people are also very shy about doing such things.
Well, then people need to get grown up.
Or get Google Glass.
You can spend $2,000 and get Google Glass, or you can just be a grown up and be like, you know what? I forgot your name, but I'm not embarrassed because I'm a human being. And I think we have meaningful stuff to talk about anyway. So forgive me. Let's move forward. But people, especially, I don't know, I feel like people in the West especially are like kind of fake. So,
wow.
Way to generalize there.
Hey, man, I'm from Brooklyn. I just say it as I hear it, as I see it. Call them as I see them.
Yeah, no, you know what? I think it'll be really interesting, and we'll find out the deeper implications that this all has in terms of how accepting society is of all of it, because, you know, a lot of people are still concerned with privacy, even in other situations where they're just putting their data, you know, outside of their local hard drives onto other servers. So I'm very curious to see how this all plays out. Yeah. I think there are some unique features from that, you know, for example, that we already have on our mobile devices where you can scan a particular product and get more information about it, like price comparisons, things of that nature. That'd be handy to that's some sort of that technology wrapped around it. Now, that's not specifically facial recognition, but that's recognition.
Using the camera in order to basically figure out more stuff about your real world. Yes. Getting some sort of clip of what's going on. Yeah, exactly. That's where Google Glass becomes really exciting. Look at that turtle. Oh, shit, that's a special type of turtle that comes from this special type of area where I am. How wonderful is that? You know? Mm-hmm. That's where I think, maybe it's because I'm a geek, but I think that that's kind of where Google Glass is really going to be great in the beginning. Like many things Google, it starts with science.
Sure. All right, moving on here. Speaking of conferences, Tim Cook spoke this week at the All Things D conference, and it was I watched his conference.
His interview,
yes, with Kara Swisher and Walt Mossberg. And it was incredibly frustrating because he said...
I thought it was really, really wonderful. He was articulate. He spoke about the company, about where it wants to go.
But for anyone that was trying to read the tea leaves about Apple, he gave up absolutely nothing.
Well, okay, that's a fan problem and not an industry problem. And I get a little frustrated with people about Apple. Like, I need to know more. The fact is, ever since 2010, Apple's been lambasted about the fact that it can't keep things private. It's been lambasted about the fact that, like, things leak out of it all the time. And ever since Tim Cook's been in charge, you know, you've been able to – they've been secretive again. And now that's a problem. There's always a problem with Apple. Doesn't matter if they're doing what people, you know, I'm just really tired of it. There's always a problem.
You people.
I just feel like it's not like when the conference, All Things D, it's about talking with industry leaders about the industry. It's not about, Tim Cook trying to hint things about what Apple's doing next. You know what I mean? That's just not, Google I.O. Google talking about what Google's doing next.
But I think WWDC, that's a legitimate question.
No, it's not, because Steve Jobs never did anything like that. It's always been about the industry.
But
a question about you and your past. Here's a question about what you've seen in the past. Here's a question about what you look forward to in the future. Where's the technology going? I don't have any data, none, that says, let me talk about our future products.
Well, I think for Kara Swisher and Walt Mossberg to ask him about what direction he thinks the company is going and get into specifics, it's legitimate questions to ask.
Steve Jobs never answered questions. Well, I'm not going to say never, but I can't recall a single time that, where is Apple going? And like, what did Steve Jobs say? He talked about computers being trucks and trucks not being what everybody needs. And that was like, no one thought about that at all when he said it. And then the iPad comes out and people play that loop, that clip over and over and over again. Yeah. And that's how these things work. So when the tech press is all up in arms, like, oh, we didn't see anything, it sucks.
Well, Tim Cook is following in Steve Jobs' footsteps in that respect.
Yeah, I mean, he's saying things about the industry, and the industry is obviously where Apple, you know, sees itself being a leader. So I think that's kind of what you have to look at. And when I see those headlines, I just feel like it's just echo chamber, not real stuff.
He was also somewhat reticent about talking about the competition, talking about Samsung. Saying that we've always had competent rivals, singling out Microsoft and Dell in the past, in relation to Google in the present. I mean, Google and Samsung in the present. And he sort of sidestepped the whole tax issue, which, I'm actually on the side of Apple in that respect. In that Apple is. And we've talked about this both on and off the show before. Apple is not exploiting, but taking advantage of legitimate tax loopholes.
They have a good accountant. That person reads the law and tells them what they can get away with, and they do it.
And I don't know why Apple is being singled out. I think maybe because they're the biggest player in the game.
Maybe, but I mean, you don't see Exxon. I think it's a lobbying thing. You don't see Exxon and Chevron up there with Apple. They make a lot of money that they hold too. And the fact is, they have lobbyists. They have whole institutes, the Institute for Coal Research, all this crap. I mean, Exxon is not an energy company; it's an oil company. But you get the idea. There are lobbyists, and there are millions of dollars spent in making sure that Congress gets the right message about what it is that these companies are doing, and Apple doesn't spend money on that level, and Google doesn't either. And if there's any place for those two companies to get together, it's in a lobbying effort that gets Congress on the side of them and ultimately the internet and the way it works. But the thing about these people that run these companies is that they're people who are people of science and people of data and people of product creation. And those sorts of people don't want to buy their way into anything. They want to schmooze their way into anything. Those sort of people want to use their ideas to move things forward. So they don't have that lobbying power, and they're making a bet that they can be successful without it. And so far they have been, and it's just a lot of politics.
Let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend this week is called Nosferatu. It's a novel by Joe Hill, the acclaimed award-winning author of New York Times bestsellers Heart-Shaped Box and Horns, and it plunges you into the dark side of imagination with a thrilling novel of supernatural suspense that will have you flinching at shadows and checking the rear view mirror again and again. Nosferatu, the notable thing that I've heard about this book, I have not actually read it, but what I've heard about it is that for those people who may or may not know, Joe Hill is the son of Stephen King. And up until this point, he has never really sort of directly addressed in his novels anything resembling his father's style. And this book, it seems to be very much inspired by Stephen King's sort of signature style. So this is sort of like the son's legacy, the first novel that he's really inspired by his dad. That book or any of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles can be yours to try out. And all you have to do to try that out is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that audiobook or any of their other titles. And even if you don't like the service, all you have to do is cancel the service, and you still get to keep the novel for free. That's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. All right, we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, NASA wants to build a real-life version of Star Trek's food replicator. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Onufowakan. Microsoft's Xbox One announcement last week was supposed to be big, shocking, and amazing. It was supposed to blow the PlayStation 4 reveal out of the water and take everybody by surprise. It was supposed to prove all of the Xbox naysayers wrong, but it didn't. In fact, it went as bad, a mess of mixed messaging and a focus on everything but games. It's been a week since the Xbox One event, and everyone's had time to mull over what they saw and heard. Gamers everywhere are grouping together and saying how much the Xbox One sucks and how much the PS4 is without doubt going to be better. Microsoft has received such negative backlash from the reveal event that the question of whether or not they've just completely screwed up the next generation for itself is becoming more prominent.
Oh man, it's like, I don't know, guys. I feel like Microsoft's getting a lot of headaches, and I'm not sure how founded they are. You know, spec for spec, the boxes don't seem that different.
No, they don't.
Service for service, they don't seem that different. But what are you seeing out there?
Microsoft
being the problem. Yeah, go ahead.
The problem is in their message. I mean, especially when it comes to this DRM situation and used games. Also, how powerful their processing, their cloud processing really is. Like, for example, you know, they made this claim that that a lot of the that they were going to take advantage of the infinite power of the cloud, claiming it'll make the Xbox One more powerful with enhanced superior games. But Jonathan Blow, the guy behind Braid and the upcoming The Witness, disagrees, saying that it's basically BS and wants to call Microsoft's bluff on this.
Is it a bluff to say that you're using the cloud, or is he just kind of like, is he just calling bullshit on it? Like, bullshit, the cloud is fast.
Yeah, I think he's calling bullshit on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't know. I hear we're going to leverage the power of the cloud, and unless you're talking about storage, you know, I don't really want to. Right. I don't want to think about Amazon EC2 servers running my shit, or the Microsoft equivalent of Amazon EC2 servers, which are probably not as fast as Amazon EC2 servers. So there's that. To me, the big turnoff with the Microsoft stuff, I mean, both Sony and Microsoft have this problem, so it's a turnoff for both of them, is the inability to basically put my DVD or whatever, or Blu-ray in the case of Sony, into the device, have it read my DVD, and say, oh, look, you have this game? This DVD actually has a serial number on it. I'm going to hold that serial number and associate it with your Xbox ID. You can now play the game. That should have been at the very first level. Even before they got into the hardware, they should have explained that situation and how you've been buying games for the past 7 years.
Right.
And we're not going to screw you over for that. Now, does that mean that when I get a new game, I can't sell it to somebody? Maybe, but you know what? How about they do it this way? How about they say, you get a new game, it associates with your account, and if you give it to someone else, you have to dissociate it with your account, and your Xbox status on that game says that you've retired. So whatever quantified information you got, whatever stats you were able to build, you're out of the loop. You know, you can see what you did, but you're not active in that game anymore, and there's some consequences for that because you gave up that. Now, that is a way that people would say, hey, I want to hold on to this. I'm a collector or whatever. And keep the gamers saying, you know, I can work with Microsoft on volume because those gray market sales don't matter as much as me not having a barrier to new sales. If I know that I can flip a game for $35 after I spent $60 in it, I'm going to buy 8 games where I would have just bought 2 before, you know? I just feel like they weren't thinking with that kind of perspective as much as they were thinking about, we want to lock down the resale of titles. And to me, that just seems backward from the way users really want to use your system.
Well, I mean, don't we notice this with a lot of companies in general? You know, AAA, yes. Where it's all about, for some reason, it always seems to be about like the legal or the business.
But it's not illegal. Well, to sell your game.
I'm expanding from that where it's not just selling games, but it's also protecting against piracy and whatnot. And there's never that person or no one listens to the people who stand up for the gamers. Even with like the SimCity debacle that we had there too. It sounded like
the Always Online thing doesn't sound like a bad thing to me. I think Always Online, if you're an Xbox guy and you're spending your $60 a month or a year on Xbox Live, then you don't mind being always online the way you would if you were a Sony player and you don't care about PSN. Or maybe you have PSN, but you're not too attached to it because you never have to pay for it or whatever. So I think the Xbox also gets money from this online situation, enough money to do things like make content deals with ESPN and enough money to do things like make sure their infrastructure stays up to snuff. So I think that Microsoft does edge out, if I were to do a comparison chart, it does edge out the PS3 with that always online ability stuff. And if they want to use that to keep the games from being pirated, I don't know how big of a piracy issue the Xbox had. I mean, I feel like after the Dreamcast, nothing's really an issue. But I really feel like piracy wasn't a huge deal, but if they really want to make it so that they're logging who's owning what game when,
then by all means, just make it so that I can transfer ownership to somebody else.
I actually do think piracy was I think there's two ways to look at it. I think to the organizations, piracy is always a big deal, but yes. I often feel like it gets they blow it way out of proportion. If you recall, there were several Xbox ban waves, which caught a lot of different users in them. They banned a ton of Xbox accounts, which as well as consoles, which led to an increase in revenue during some Christmas sales. It was very interesting watching right. the whole ordeal.
I guess what I'm saying is Blizzard has a pretty good situation where they're like, hey, look, you bought a game, put in your code. It's going to go to battle.net. It's associated with your ID. That's what's up. Guess what? No matter where you are, you can go to battle.net and download the game and play it as long as you log in as yourself. Only one of you can be online at a time, but so be it. That's a pretty exciting way to deal with it. The compromise there is that, fine, I can't copy some disc and give it to my friend and play against him online, but I know that if I lose my disc, if I lose my CD key, it's not going to get in the way of me playing this game. Right? Like, is that not a – do you guys see that as a reasonable compromise? You get something, they get peace of mind, you get peace of mind.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see why Microsoft, having access to discs, having access to the cloud, always being online, couldn't do that themselves. And, you know, even because of the disc situation, build in the fact that, hey, you want to give this to somebody else? Sure. You're going to get excluded from whatever changes. You're not going to be able to download new downloadable content. You're not going to be able to do any of that stuff. But the fact is, there you go. Because I look at the other guys in the game space that people don't talk about. Well, people talk about them, but not in the same vein. But I look at Apple and Google and what happens when you download a console game, right? Not a console game, a mobile game. Now, I'll download a mobile game. I'll get updates every 2 weeks if the mobile game's good. And it may not – and some of them are 3D. Some of them are immersive games or whatever. But the fact is I get updates. I can play it on any device I want. I'm never concerned about trying to give it to my friend or whatever. And I have no issues with that. I granted, I pay less for those games. A really good mobile game is maybe $15. But as the Ouya quickly approaches, and it really is coming soon, you've got to think about what the options are for these guys who are distributing these games and what the options are for users who buy them. And I think that the straight up download model is something that we can all get behind as long as the games are reasonably priced.
Are you starching your shirts?
Is there like a cicada behind somebody?
I cannot quiet my cicada.
So you've got a cicada and that was my starch. Yeah. Yes. You can't get nothing. You can't have the same exact model you had before, but there's got to be some way to get a compromise going.
Right, but I don't know. I often find that they don't want to compromise is usually the case.
They know people will buy.
Right, and it's usually, well, we can have it our way. And from what we've been hearing of late, it sounds like places like Blockbuster have been running out of their have filled their pre-order inventory for the Xbox One. So, you know, who knows? Who knows how much it will actually affect them in the long haul, but it's...
Yeah, how are they going to deal with the rental situation? They're just cutting that out. I guess you just can't rent if it's based on that. You can't have the services that allow you to, like, borrow a game for a few days because logged in.
It's hard to say because I think the main issue that a lot of people are having here is just that Microsoft isn't being honest. And why be afraid of it?
Yeah, they don't have to be afraid. They can just say what's up.
Because it's going to have to come out at some point. Unless they haven't made a decision, which I would be very troubled if they're still wavering at this point, this close to something like E3 where... We're all assuming it got announced, or at least hear a little bit more about it.
We know that they haven't made some decisions yet. If they knew about pricing and availability, they would have taken a page from Apple's book, and they just would have said, it's coming out on September 21st, and it's going to be $599. And we'd all be like, man, that's expensive. But hey, it's not as bad as it was. It's the same price it was when it first came out the Xbox 360 first came out. And there'd be a talk about that, and people would go, and they'd rush home, they'd look at their accounts, and they'd figure out how much they have to save between now and then to buy it, right? Like, that's what would happen. Pre-orders are starting on some day. But for whatever reason, they haven't made that decision yet, which is a stupid decision in late May when this stuff has to come out in time for Christmas. You know, let's give the youngsters the ability, or anybody really, the ability to save up and get ready to spend their hard-earned, you know, summer internship or summer job mowing lawns for your device. Get that, yeah. Get that budget. Get that.
But pricing, right? And availability is one thing, and then the other is really core to how the system actually works. And at this point, you would think that they would have that clearly defined, or that's at least – or you know, maybe even the issue is their PR. It's like some high-level
that's
people
a big
say
issue.
One thing, other people say another. No one can give a consistent story, and it's like –
Last
Come
time
on,
I checked,
guys.
It was Edelman.
Yeah, for sure. There's that is one big issue. You see conflicting reports. You see, you know, one person saying that, and I'm quoting here from Phil Harrison, Microsoft's VP of Business, that you can take your game around to your friend's house just as you would today. And what we're doing with the new live technology is that with the disk, it's just a repository for the bits. You put that disk into the drive. You can play the game while you're there and then go home and take that disk with you. But the bits are still on his drive. If your friend decides he really likes to play that game, then he can go buy it instantly and it doesn't need to download again. It's already there once he's paid for it. It's immediately there.
Because it's installed or something.
Yeah. So there is going to be
taking up hard drive space. That means it's taking up hard drive space if you don't use it.
Right. Yes. That, again, another problem. And we're not even getting into used game licenses, which GameSpot took things a step further to find out from retailers exactly how much the total license would cost. And they received figures that approximated around $52 to purchase a used game license, based on the talks retailers have had with Microsoft. So,
and they've got to mark that up, right? Yeah, so like GameStop might get at $52, but they've got to make a margin on it. Let's say they make a margin of 10%. That's $60.
On a $60 disc.
On a game that was $60 to begin with. So what happens then? You're like, screw your used game. I'm going to get a new game.
Yeah.
And then there's some actual negative externalities there, because now Microsoft has to produce – you know, they're publishers have to produce new discs. So now we have all these discs flooding the market, and you know, that's not good.
It's like AOL syndrome all over again, right?
Exactly.
It's no wonder that GameSpot stock dropped significantly after the Microsoft Xbox One announcement.
Yeah, I mean, if you're GameStop, you gotta. I mean, first of all, can anyone help me out? How come GameStop isn't selling related content? How come I can't walk into GameStop and get a comic book on any game, right? Like, why isn't that happening?
Yeah.
Like, why aren't they selling, you know, they should be selling the related content. They should be selling toys. They should have put comic book stores out of business by now. If they had this is that innovator's dilemma.
they're going to need to pivot or die.
Yeah, they should have been selling the related content. They should have been having, you know, situations where they have, you know, a little space set up in their store for people to bring their own consoles in and do a little, like, whatever. Or maybe even you register in GameStop and, you know, there's some way to figure out, you know, how you did in a tournament, right? GameStop should be working with Microsoft to say, I want to host a Halo tournament and the winner will get this many Xbox dollars or something hosted by GameSpot. You know, like, there's... I feel like they're just like, oh, we're going to be brick and mortar store that sells people games. Yeah, 2013. Yep.
You remember a while back we talked about Blizzard's new, you know, top secret project, codenamed Titan, and how this was like the first Blizzard project that they basically it's the first thing that they've done, new thing that they've done since World of Warcraft.
It's a new title, yeah.
Yeah. So the team of 100 developers working on it has been reduced by 70 positions, and Blizzard is reassigning those people to other work. Meanwhile,
is it laying them off? Have we heard anything about that?
I think one way or the other, they're not working on Titan. Either laying them off or reassigning. It says here in the article that they're reassigning them to other work. So essentially, the title's not expected to be published until 2016 at the earliest. The problem delaying the game is that, of course, Blizzard's going to face a lot more competition. Bethesda Softworks is planning to show a version of its Elder Scrolls online at the upcoming E3. So they've just lost that lead time. It's unfortunate because their project looked really interesting. I guess they were just not ready to.
Well, man, when Blizzard wants to do something, they really do it right. And I got to say, StarCraft was held back a few times.
Yeah.
And it was worth the wait. But Diablo was held back. I don't know if many people thought that was as worth the wait as StarCraft, but, you know, it sold well because people really liked it. And if they're looking at what they want to do with this MMO and they decide to hold back because they want to put the talent in things that are working, this is one company, I think, that has the capital to do that.
Yeah, they've done this several times in the past. The real question, though, is can World of Warcraft hold on as long for the... Well, can World of Warcraft fans hold off long enough for this to go out? Because it sounds like they're losing a lot of players to other things.
Right. World of Warcraft has pretty much run its course where the technology is concerned. And the development time to create a new platform that would get people interested in, you know, will rival what's going on here as well. So it's I don't know. It's an interesting thing. I don't like to obviously like I don't know. I've enjoyed Blizzard products. I think that they're one of the few game companies that's been able to keep its heart and soul during this merger of all things gaming companies. You know, the Activision merger allowed them to stay mostly unique and whole. And that's pretty powerful. So if this is the way they think they have to do it, then I gotta say, until we see otherwise, that's something. They're incredibly creative. They're huge, but there's kind of, don't you guys think they're kind of boutique-y in a way? They've only really got three titles, even though they're, you know, one of the biggest developers out there.
Yeah.
I think this is an interesting. It's a worthy story to talk about. It's really strange. I don't know that there are conclusions to make just yet. It's just it's sad that they won't be able to deliver on time. I know I've been waiting for it. And I was even going to buy a new computer just in anticipation of new Blizzard titles coming out. So it's a little sad.
Yeah, but I guess very interestingly enough. I'm very curious how far along development they were, because they had, at least according to the article, was it like 70?
Yep, 70 people.
And that's a large workforce to suddenly say, okay, stop what you're doing. We don't believe this is useful. Let's pivot.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big, big, big decision. And I don't know, I feel like, that's a huge decision. You're right. That's like that's an incredibly large decision to make. I guess they can. Yeah.
And they are a gutsy company.
Exactly.
All right. Let's talk about our last story here before we talk about our viral video of the week. A 3D food printer might evoke visions of the replicator popularized in Star Trek, from which Captain Picard was constantly interrupting himself to order tea. Now, Systems and Materials Research Corporation, led by Engine Contractor, just got a six-month, $125,000 grant from NASA to create a prototype of a universal food synthesizer. Contractor sees a day when every kitchen has a 3D printer and the Earth's 12 billion people feed themselves customized, nutritionally appropriate meals synthesized one layer at a time from cartridges of powder and oils they buy at the corner grocery store. His vision would mean the end of food waste because the powder his system will use is shelf stable for 30 years, so that each cartridge, whether it contains sugar, complex carbohydrates, protein, or some other basic building block, would be fully exhausted before being returned to the store.
Sounds delicious.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it may sound a little unappealing, but
wait. It doesn't sound a little unappealing.
Okay, but the reality of the situation is that we're running out of food. You know, engine contractor says, I think, and many economists think, that current food systems can't supply the 12 billion people sufficiently, so we eventually have to change our perception of what we see as food.
Or maybe we have to stop making people. I don't know.
Well, yeah.
I'm going to put that out there.
Yeah. I think he's trying to solve one problem here.
Yeah, and that problem is saying, okay, we're human beings. We live on this planet. That's the problem. We don't live on Earth. We're a part of Earth.
Yes, yes.
There's an ecosystem here. There are plants and other things that grow. I have tomatoes growing in my front yard. I have peppers growing in my front yard. Yeah. I got basil growing. That's what you heard me spraying. And the fact is, that is food. I don't live in Boulder, Colorado, so I could eat a paste. I live in here because it's, you know, got the most restaurants per capita in the entire country almost. And it's got artisanal everything you'd ever want to eat. And that world with 12 billion people, I mean – Let's get the CIA to start a nuclear war between India and China. And just get rid of 2 billion people right there. That's what, 2.6 million people?
I think you just started a Kickstarter.
I don't know. I look at things economically. I don't often have a lot of like human passion.
Common sense? Or
no, it's common sense.
Views of Dwayne do not represent the views of
the drill down or the American government. But when you look at it from an analysis perspective, you know, like there's that new movie, Elysium, coming out.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? If you've ever been, I don't know if you guys have ever been to India, but if you've been there, the images from that film fairly accurately depict this world where it's so crowded.
Yeah.
And there's not enough resources. So the thing that's cheapest is humanity.
Oh, so the point is, regardless of, you know, our views on zero population growth, this guy is trying to solve a problem, and they've already he's already created a, like, his rudimentary sort of a proof of concept for this 3D food printer was he made pizza. You know, he made like a rudimentary type of pizza with using tomato powder and protein and wheat, and layered them all in a pizza like substrate. You know,
it wasn't even gluten free.
No. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's something that you can.
I'm joking, dude. I'm joking.
It's something that the astronauts. I mean, the idea is with the NASA thing is that it's going to start off as a NASA project first. So astronauts, you know, take this food printer up there. They can bring it on board the ISS with a 30-month supply of component food materials, and then just print out whatever meals they want to.
And that makes a lot of sense. It doesn't make a lot of sense for this idea that we're people living on Earth that can grow things and eat them. But it makes a lot of sense. I feel like the 12 billion people situation is really problematic, and it leaves you in that Elysium style, Calcutta style place where you're there's no peace or anything. And the idea that you're going to be using this, and it's an outer space thing, and maybe it comes down here. A lot of great things came from outer space.
Sure.
Into our houses, like microprocessors and so on. But the fact is, so did Tang. The one thing they ate out there.
And food sticks. Are you dissing Tang and food sticks?
I'm just saying. Like, you're laughing for a reason. You know, like, it's you know, Tang and then those space dots. Have you tried the actual, like, quote-unquote astronaut ice cream? Not the space dots, but the hard thing that's kind of like styrofoam. But
the
freeze-dried
ice cream?
Yeah, so that's expensive. That hasn't gone down in price. Yeah. That hasn't become cheaper over the last, I don't know, 30 years since we started sending, you know. It's just not a – we've been sending people since 19, you know, 60-something. People got on the moon in, what, 69? So that's, like, you know, 44 years ago people landed on the moon.
Yeah.
And this ice cream, I don't know when they started selling it, but or making it, but this ice cream hasn't gotten any cheaper. So I'm just saying, I don't have a lot of is this one of those dilemmas of innovation? perhaps. If there's a refugee situation, an earthquake happens in a place like Haiti, the fact that you can bring these devices out and these really inconvenient blocks of food and
inexpensive
people,
raw materials.
If it's inexpensive enough and you can bring this out and you can get that done, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. But there's a difference between...
Well, I haven't even told you.
There's a difference between, like, living and thriving.
Yeah,
and it doesn't sound to me at this point in technology, and obviously this technology always gets better, or maybe, Tang, I don't know. It doesn't sound to me as if this is something that benefits – it can keep humans alive.
Yeah.
But it doesn't benefit humanity necessarily.
I haven't even told you what they're intending to create the protein nutrients out of.
As long as it's not soy, I think I'll be fine.
It's granulated mealworms is the idea.
That's fine.
Because they're rich and plentiful and full of protein.
And they're cheap to make.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, frankly, when you look at some of the really sustainable ways to make beef.
Yeah.
New York Times had a great article on this. It's not coming from cows, which take a lot of energy. It takes like 2 pounds. It takes like several pounds of a feed to make 1 pound of beef.
Right.
And it takes a lot less to make 1 pound of like guinea pig meat, you know?
Right.
And guinea pig meat is something that people are eating as a delicacy right now, but it's a really sustainable way to get, you know, protein in your body. Does it have as much fat? No. That's probably a good thing for our hearts. Does fat not taste good? Does the lack of fat taste great? No, people like the taste of fat. That's why we eat it. But so, I mean, I think they're, you know, guinea pigs, the idea that we eat them is kind of gross. I get it for a lot of people. But I feel like that to me is actually a better solution than eating, you know, a block of stuff cut into a weird pizza. You know, that's just...
All the same, I appreciate that someone is attempting to tackle this problem.
How about a weaponized virus? That's like really clean, right?
Again, if you want to back this Kickstarter early, just contact Dwayne.
Okay, hold on. Back up and do not say my email address over the thing. Yeah, you should bleep it out.
All right. So
yeah,
let's
back my Kickstarter. My Kickstarter will be to. Where our plan is to raise enough money to destroy 1/3 of mankind. That's enough to get us back on track, people.
All right, let's talk about the viral video of the week. So this is a Sony's PS4 teaser video, and this actually came out last week, and I wasn't even aware of it, or not last week. I think maybe 2 weeks ago. This came out shortly after Sony's preview launch of the PS4, where they didn't show anything. They showed this teaser video, and this teaser video is it's basically a it's supposed to tease the actual product itself, the actual console itself, which we didn't get to see any of during their preview launch. All we saw was the controller with the touch interface on the front, and this teaser video is short little screenshots of elements of the device. You don't even get to see the entire device. You just see quick flash frames of elements of the device. But to follow up with this, what I thought was incredibly fascinating is a user on Reddit took these little screenshots and pieced them together, essentially put the jigsaw puzzle of these pieces together, and used 3D modeling program, in this case Blender, and created a representation of what the PS4 might look like.
An artist's rendering.
An artist's rendering based on these solely on these little screenshots. And I think they did a fairly accurate job. And if you look at, we'll have it linked in the show notes. Already, it's a sleeker looking device than the Microsoft Xbox One. It's got a little bit of a sort of a diagonal design element to it that's nice.
Yeah. Wouldn't actually, you know, speaking about the whole Microsoft Sony thing, wouldn't it be really hilarious if, because Sony was so tight-lipped about what it looked like and even some of the extra items surrounding it. They were just kind of waiting for Microsoft's announcement, and once they saw the box, they're like, oh shit, let's make ours a little bit sleeker. And, oh shit, DRM, we've got to be careful about this.
I don't know. I feel like Sony, it's so like their fans. I mean, Sony fans are really hardcore. The people who have like mini disc players and who just use memory sticks with a Band-Aid and you know, they only buy Sony TVs. And I say that having a Sony TV, they're the kind of people who Sony releases this like tiny little like funny shaped thing that like doesn't plug into anything. And they're like, if you're really clever, you can see the game. Like the Emperor has no clothes kind of thing.
Yeah.
I can see them releasing something that's like, it's just a concept. And people are like, oh my God, Sony is so amazing. I totally see the BioShock. Hmm. And it's not even like in front of them. So I think Sony can get away with whatever. When the PS3 came out, a lot of people were like, ooh, I don't know. And, you know, it's a very different and unique looking device. The Xbox was way more straightforward. I really think with the Xbox One, they're trying to get more people to get in the living room, so they're going with a really conservative look. It's square, it's black, it's whatever. Whereas the first Xbox 360 came out, it was white, like an iPod. It was nuts. So I can just see Sony coming out with something that's going to look like it was made by, you know, some alien, you know, that's eating food made from a replicator.
All the same, you know, I think Sony did the right thing in holding their cards close to the vest and waiting until after Microsoft announced their Xbox launch before divulging more information. Because at least this way, even if everything is exactly the same fundamentally as the Xbox One, they can control their message.
Right. It's also helpful because, you know, they talked about specs, and then it was Microsoft's turn, and now it's their turn again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Microsoft can then come out during E3 and talk about pricing and availability, and Sony can look at that pricing and say, okay, we're going to price it slightly differently. Microsoft was this. We're going to make ours 10% more expensive because we're Sony. That kind of thing.
And by the way, I'll be going to E3 in a couple of weeks, too, so we'll report from E3 after I've come back.
I wonder, now that we've seen all three consoles, I wonder if...
There's a fourth console.
...is actually the best... initial demo.
Which console are you talking about, Dwayne? Is the fourth console
the Ouya?
The Ouya. I've got. I just received a notice in my mail that my Ouya is on the way.
So there's a fourth console.
Yeah,
it's a true console.
Yeah, but we've already. I mean, I think we already have seen that the Ouya is kind of a non-starter. At least not if you're going to put it up against the big three.
I don't know. I mean, who knows? Maybe during WWDC, we'll find out there's a new Apple TV or there's an update to the Apple TV that allows you to use an iPhone or an iPod Touch to control games. And that changes stuff, too.
I think if I had to put my money down right now on one of the big three, well, I mean, the Wii U is completely out of the picture. So it's between the Xbox One and the PS4, and right now it would have to be the PS4 is where I'd put my money on. I think I'll know more once we get into E3.
I don't know. Halo is the kind of title that really blows these things away. I don't know. I think it's too early to tell. I got my hopes up for the Ouya. If not this Ouya, then when they make some revision in a couple months after they release this puppy, it's just so amazing. People are like, oh my God, I can't believe it, and they go and they buy it. And that'll be awesome, but that's also not based on any real data, and it's kind of crazy to say. So,
what would you buy if you had to buy one right now, Tosin?
I had to buy one. That's a good question. A Raspberry Pi? No, I don't know. Probably a PS4.
Really? I feel like the Xbox has the oneness aspect, though. So, like, even if the games are awful, you can still use it for other things.
But I think for me, I already have that functionality in the segments of that I already need it, and it would be cool to have that. But I feel like I'm just so discouraged about potential DRM and potential borrowing discs that I just, at least so far, Sony hasn't. You know, although Sony may be doing the same things, they haven't discouraged me in that same nature. And right now, it's more about which company feels better.
I gotcha. All I have to say about it is that I have exactly one HDMI port left on my television set. So, given that the Xbox One doesn't play Xbox 360 games, of which I have several, it's going to be one or the other. You know, like I guess I don't have the ports. I just don't have the ports.
Yeah. And I feel like the Microsoft's concession to the set-top box for this new box, which is the HDMI pass-through, which you would pass your cable box through, and it would exist as a layer over that signal, which would then, you know, the Xbox One would then control the cable box with an IR blaster. It's a really convoluted way of approaching that problem, and I think that I would wait until the next generation, where you have TV actually integrated into the system. It's basically we need to wait until cable is dead, and people are getting all of their
cable
TV content.
Box. I mean, like, let's face it, this device is powerful enough to do the functions of a cable box, so there should be a mode that is cable box mode.
Right. But there isn't.
Like it's I don't know exactly. I feel like if any company could pull that off, it is Microsoft, right?
Yeah.
Sony makes its own content too, but if any company could really pull that off, Microsoft should be able to say, "Hey, you know, Comcast, what are you using? Motorola, some other guy? Like, hey, look at my box. What can we do with my box to get your TV pumped in through here?" And if Comcast were really smart, or Time Warner were really smart, they'd be like, "Yeah, I'll make that bet. I'll support your Xbox stuff. I don't know what it's going to take, but let's work on that from the beginning to make sure it does take that. Because I know that I'll have a chance of someone saying, well, I don't want a cable box. I don't want to whatever. Having this really cool interface, this Kinect-based interface to look at normal TV. I mean, that's cool. And I think that's actually where the Microsoft device has the advantage. If I had to buy one today, I think I still might lean Microsoft because I know that that Kinect feature set is going to be a really cool way to get around my TV.
Yeah. I mean, I like the fact that they're making a good attempt there. They're trying to integrate it in as much as they can, but the barrier really isn't with the device itself. It's with the cable companies.
Mm-hmm.
They won't allow, you know, that sort of cable card integration with these consoles.
I know. Is cable card still alive?
I think barely.
Yeah, I mean, cable card was great. You just had your TV.
Yeah.
You put a card in, and you were set. And then suddenly, it just stopped working, and yada, yada, yada. And it's that box is the problem. The cable box is the problem.
All right, let's wrap this up here. Let me go around the table here. I'm going to start with you, Duane. Where can we find your work online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
Find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD. Check out what I do on flavors.me/DwayneD, and then check me out on the Drill Down.
Cool. And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/Toast, T-O-A-S-T, 4321, as well as you can find my other random ramblings on ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
As for myself, you can find me at mrbabyman.com. And facebook.com/MrBabyMan and twitter.com/MrBabyMan. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about on the Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on our site. You can always let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of the Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.